Hello and welcome to Hear Her, the podcast of UNFPA East and Southern Africa. With the global population recently reaching 8 billion, we can celebrate many signs of human progress. Yet a sobering reality is how uneven progress has been and how systematically violence against women and girls still robs so many of dignity, well-being, and the right to peace. In this podcast, you will hear voices from all walks of life with a common vision of building a more just, equitable, and sustainable future we all desire. Their voices matter, and it is the heart of all we do at UNFPA as we adapt to a changing world.
In this episode, we're talking cyberbullying. What exactly is cyberbullying? The internet and mobile phones have had such positive potential to transform people's lives for the better. However, when they are misused, they can cause real pain. Over the last decade or so, advancements in cyberspace have enabled greater connectivity between people across geographical divides. While people certainly gain benefits from such technological advancements, considerable attention has also been paid to the negative side effects of cyber activity. Cyberbullying, popularized as virtual abuse, is defined as intentionally aggressive behavior that is implemented via digital communication, such as email, text messages, or mobile phone. Many studies note that it has been linked to a host of negative outcomes at both the physical and psychological levels. To give us a better idea on the issue, we spoke to Dean McCoubry, the founder of My Social Life, which teaches online safety to young people. We asked him for his thoughts on cyberbullying and what it's all about.
There are so many different types of cyberbullying out there because they've become so nuanced. They almost come from one family, one overarching family, which is normally about antagonizing, shaming, and embarrassment of some form or other. But the actual types are trolling, flaming, shaming, doxing, outing, catfishing, sextortion, and they're all very different. I can explain them to you in different ways, but ultimately they are these very nuanced, and this is why it makes it so difficult for parents and teachers to understand, is because unless you understand the platforms and understand the way in which teens and preteens communicate inside those platforms, whether they be text, whether they be photographic, whether they be video, whether they be gaming, those could almost trigger different types of antagonism, shaming, and embarrassment. So I often explain it that to some degree, doing the job that I do, I feel like I'm sitting inside a lion enclosure, but I never poke the lion. I just listen. And from the ability to sit inside these assembly halls, and where the children explain to us what's happening, you can start to see these connection points of the types of platform or the types of media, and therefore how that leads into the certain types of cyberbullying. So, for example, some kids just plain troll. That means they're just going to say horrible smack to you. Now, other kids might do catfishing. Now, catfishing is when you impersonate somebody. You go onto the internet, you download an image of somebody else, you download the name of that person, and then you pretend to be that person in order to slowly build trust with the child or the individual. And you, in building the trust, you get their secrets or you get their photographs, and then you can publicly use those photographs and either bribe them, or you can shame them and embarrass them and get other people to laugh or get other people to dislike them and so on. You then have things like image-based violence, which means that you use images, embarrassing images, and you publicly share those. Do you remember right at the beginning when I first started talking, I'd mentioned that things were public? So now many, many people can see them inside these vast networks, vast social networks. So a group of 100 people, if three people reshare that, that goes into another three sets of 100 people, could even be 1,000 people, could be 50,000 people. And that ultimately these branches start to spin out to have these huge reach, this huge reach of exposure. It's called an OTS score, an opportunity to see score. You can post something, but once it starts getting shared and unshared and shared and unshared, it then reaches vast into this network to have actually a massive reach of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. So when you have this image that can publicly shame, embarrass somebody, it can be incendiary, literally incendiary, by the way in which it just catches fire and rushes like an inferno through social networks if it is a really antagonistic post.
The UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund agency dedicated to advancing sexual and reproductive health and rights, is there to help those who are being targeted by technologically facilitated gender-based violence. To get a clear definition of what it's about, here's Julie Diallo, a regional gender program specialist for the UNFPA Regional Office for East and Southern Africa.
So UNFPA understanding of technological facilitated gender-based violence is really looking at any act of violence perpetrated by one or more individual that is committed, assisted, aggravated, and amplified in part or fully by the use of information and communication technology or digital media against a person on the basis of the gender. But the very important thing is that there is a lack of consensus globally on the definition of violence that is perpetrated using technology and committed through online and digital space. So the way that I view technological facilitated gender-based violence is that it's part of the continuum of gender-based violence. And technological facilitated gender-based violence include hate speech, hacking, identity theft, online stalking, concealing suicide. Really, we have seen a lot of things, women and girls trafficking and sex trade. So it's really part of that entire GBV continuum. The way that it affects women and girls globally and in Africa, it's quite wide. So, you know, if you look at gender-based violence and the latest estimate of WHO on violence against women and girls prevalence, it shows that one out of three women in Africa report having experienced physical and or sexual violence by a partner or a non-partner. And we know that the online space creates opportunities for perpetrators of gender-based violence to exacerbate violence against women and girls. When we don't have enough data, the recent studies that we have at the moment, and it was conducted by the Economic Intelligence Unit in 2021, show that among women in 51 countries with the highest internet penetration rates, it showed that globally 38% of women with internet access have personally experienced online violence. 63% of women know someone who had been subjected to it, and 85% of women have witnessed online violence being perpetrated against another woman. And if we look at regional estimates, so if we look at the continent, the prevalence is extremely high. It shows that the prevalence of online violence in Africa was 90%.
Cyberbullying includes actions to manipulate, harass, and defame any person. These hostile actions are seriously damaging and can affect anyone easily and gravely. They take place on social media, public forums, and other online information websites. A cyberbully is not necessarily a stranger. It may also be someone you know. Cyberbullying has become very common nowadays. Some might say that gender-based cyberviolence was hard to imagine 30 years ago, as the means to commit online violence mostly didn't exist back then. Online gender-based violence is targeted harassment and prejudice through technology against people, disproportionately women, based on their gender.
The question of whether cyberbullying is really the next level of bullying due to the access that we have to devices and the internet is always a very interesting one. The reality is that it's very, very layered. What we see is that when you do have a device, the content that's on there is always on. It's viral and it's public. And for that reason, yes, access to a device or owning a device and being able to connect to the internet and being able to get onto social platforms means that there is a very real reason why cyberbullying has increased. However, we need to understand that the deeper part of being human is that we do have insecurity. We are fearful of things. We do have anxiety. We have triggers. And all of those bring up or stir up emotions deep inside us, which then have reactions or behaviors that we start to employ, and those spill out in different ways. So what I'm trying to say is, if you took the devices away again, we would still have the same volume of bullying that we probably have today, because ultimately this is about being human. Humans experience bullying, so then they perpetuate bullying themselves. It can be sitting inside their experience. But the aspect of just being human and being insecure, fearful, and so on means that we sometimes want to make ourselves feel better. We want to dominate other people. We want to keep people underneath us. We see this in politics. We see it in communities. We see it in schools. And so ultimately, those are really the initial deeper triggers of bullying. But now they're spilling out online simply because there is, as I said, this virality, this ability to share something that's shaming is something that is quite rewarding for some people. It makes you feel better tenfold because now you've publicly shamed them. That is something that has really added extra fuel to the fire. I think what we are seeing in South Africa and Southern Africa specifically is that we have problems that perhaps some other countries don't have. Specifically, in some of these countries, we have problems where there is a large exposure to violence, which we see in social media and media. And when that sits in your environment, when you're consuming what you see in the media and on social media, that is then being stored inside you and can have an impact on you. It can be a trigger, which can then like set off those behaviors, which could either be offline or online. So there's a huge number of factors here, which I always find incredibly interesting to work on.
While most of the harassment we hear about takes place on social media, according to international studies, almost 60% occurs in other online venues such as text messaging, chat groups or forums, or even online gaming. Bullying and harassment can focus on many different issues, ranging from political and religious to other issues such as physical appearance, gender, career choice, ethnicity, or sexual orientation. While the person harassing you might be a stranger, they can also be someone you know, such as a neighbor, co-worker, former romantic partner, or other acquaintance.
What we have seen with technological facilitate violence, we have seen different factors that are really enabling and driving technology-assisted gender-based violence. So the first element, it's really like the anonymity. You know, the perpetrator or the abuser remain anonymous. We have the distance. That means that the action can be perpetrated at distance from anywhere in the world and without personal or physical contact with the survivor. So you can really imagine also how it creates like some issue in terms of accountability and access to justice. You have the accessibility and the affordability. It's accessible and affordable to the perpetrator to really perpetrate the violence. There is the propagation. It's really like it's a constant and easily propagated through the internet, really re-traumatizing the survivor all the time. And then you have the impunity. It is often perpetrated with impunity because a technological facilitated gender-based violence can be committed anonymously from a distance. So there are really a lot of difficulty in terms of law enforcement across country. There is the automation. So the automation, it means that it can be automatic and easy to perpetrate and allow perpetrators to control women's movement, monitor the online activity, distribute image or information. And there is the collectivity element. It can be collectively organized and perpetrated by a large number of individuals using, again, the same image, the same messaging. And there is the perpetuity. It can be committed in perpetuity because we know that image and digital material used to perpetrate abuse are likely to exist indefinitely for a very long period of time. So in a way, this is all those elements really like contribute to normalize violence.
You see, the kids all play a lot of online games. So they've got platforms there where they all chat to each other, which means they don't necessarily know each other. They might have played against each other a couple of times. They might recognize the name or the nickname or whatever it is, but they generally haven't met in real life.
The platforms that we find the most cyberbullying on might surprise you. I'm not going to say about South Africa just yet, but internationally, the most fascinating is that Instagram is number one. Why would that be? It would be simply because when you are seeing somebody's life, first of all, when you have a large volume of users on that platform, that means that there's a huge amount of people that can therefore comment. But when you post that stuff out there, and it's a type of platform which is very visual, and it shows off your life, your academic achievements, your social standing, the way in which you look, whatever it may be, your talents, that ultimately, coming back, it can trigger envy inside us. It can trigger so many different perspectives from so many different people that everybody has a different view about your somewhat innocent post. Everybody of the 7.5 billion people in the world, based upon their own life experiences and families, will view that post differently. Some will view it supportively, and some will view it as, this is unacceptable. How dare you say that? Or, you know, who do you think you are? Why are you showing me this life of yours? So ultimately, that's why Instagram, this incredibly aesthetic community that's showing these beautiful snapshot moments, is something that can be so triggering for somebody, because we're often showing these perfect lives. But locally, I would say that from a cyberbullying point of view, you are largely going to be looking at some of these apps like AMA apps, Ask Me Anything apps, where there is anonymity. Because as soon as you become anonymous, you can dial up the level of flaming and trolling. You can literally say anything. And I've seen it personally. I've done some tracking through Instagram and into these AMA apps. Now, I say through Instagram because what a lot of teens can do is inside their Instagram profile, they have the ability to have a link, like a link tree. And that just means you can have an account which says at my social life SA, and it says for more information, go to this link or these links. That's what a link tree is. It gives you a whole load of options to go and find out. But kids are putting the link into their anonymous accounts on these AMA apps so that people can go and ask them this crazy stuff because it's titillating, it's exhilarating, it's funny, it's curious, it's voyeuristic. All of this reason is the reason why kids want to publicly put their AMA account, whatever it may be. It could be something like QMe, you know, there are many different types of apps, but it could be something like that so that you can go and have a bit of fun in the anonymity of the web. And it's those apps that specifically shine out for cyberbullying.
But who is in the firing line? Much research on cyberbullying worldwide has been based on teenagers and young adults, and it's indeed within these age groups that it's mostly seen. While young adults of 18 to 25 experience the highest levels of cyberbullying, the prevalence of cyberbullying was lower amongst those in older age groups. One question that is often asked is, what legal recourse do I have against the perpetrator in my country?
So about the legal framework in the continent, what we see is that according to a UN report from 2018, we saw that 12 African member states had basic law provision in place, protecting women from technology-assisted gender-based violence. And most African states did not have specific legal provision on cybercrime and electronic evidence in force. But there are ongoing efforts made by African member states to draft or to amend, depending on the context, legislation to effectively protect women and girls in the online space.
Emma Sadler is the founder of the Digital Law Company, which specializes in advising on the legal and reputational risks of using social media. She is the co-author of the book Don't Film Yourself Having Sex and Other Legal Advice for the Age of Social Media, and the author of Selfies, Sex and Smartphones.
So that's called Selfies, Sex and Smartphones, A Teenager's Online Survival Guide. And I think of that as the K53 to owning a smartphone. You know, before you're allowed to drive a car, which is a dangerous thing, you have to get a learner's license. And then pass a driver's license when you're allowed to drive it without your parents helping you or without somebody keeping an eye on how you're going. And I think very much the same way, I think of that yellow book. It's blue in English, in Afrikaans, it's yellow in English, as sort of the K53 to owning a smartphone. It covers all the big issues that we deal with at schools, from sexting, cyberbullying, addiction, gaming, chain of publication, legal issues, capacity, when the law starts applying to you, all that kind of thing. My first book is called Don't Film Yourself Having Sex. And that is a book, which is really, I should have called it the Social Media Law Handbook. It's really a codification of the law as it was a couple of years ago. Things have changed a little bit, but certainly the principles are the same. And about a quarter of it is what the laws are. About a quarter of it is how to deal with social media in the workplace, hiring, firing, when Big Brother can watch you, when they can intercept your emails, that kind of thing. About a quarter of it is children, and about a quarter of it is just general stuff like how to stay safe online dating, that kind of thing. So the two books have done very well. They're both bestsellers. I've also written the social media law chapter of the communications law textbook. It's great, but sometimes, as I say, the law changes. So what we've actually done more recently is brought out an online product, the Digital Law Academy, which allows children and parents and teachers and people in the corporate world to sign up and do a course, which is great because I can keep it updated when there are new legal developments. So that's the kind of the most up-to-date offering that we have. I would say that the worst age group that I'm dealing with at the moment are really the kind of tweens. So that's literally from sort of 10 years old to 14 years old, sometimes up to 16. That seems to be the worst age group, particularly the 12 and 13-year-olds. I think it's when the kids get onto these platforms for the first time. They're on WhatsApp groups. They are trying to be cool. They're not quite sure about who they are themselves yet. And I think that the consequences are not yet that apparent to them, and they struggle to appreciate the consequences of the messages that they're sending. So I'm seeing a lot of that kind of age group falling foul of bullying rules, but also laws around bullying.
Sensitive children get bullied. They're easy targets because they react, because they get upset. And that's what the bully's after. They're after that reaction. I think even in some of the cases, if I think about my son's girlfriend who has these guys asking her for all kinds of inappropriate things, it's opportunistic because, you know, it'd be nice to get one, but it's also that kind of power play. And if she doesn't respond, then they carry on.
How much of cyberbullying is actually gender versus gender? Is it men giving women a hard time? Who exactly is responsible for a lot of what is going on in a young woman's life?
If we look at the continent, given the digital gender divide, we really see that women and girls are users, but with limited digital skills that really put them more at risk of technology-assisted gender-based violence. When you have people non-gender conforming that really go outside of the social norms or what is expected of a typical man behavior, they are targeted. When you look also on specific feminist issue and when you see men coming as ally, supporting a feminist agenda or supporting a woman right agenda, men are targeted as well.
Girls are more likely than boys to be both victims and perpetrators of cyberbullying. 15% of teen girls have been the target of at least 4 different kinds of abusive online behaviors, compared with 6% of boys. And about half of the LGBTQ+ students experience online harassment, a rate higher than average. With all that's happening online and almost everybody able to access social media, who are the people who are most at risk and in the firing line when it comes to this particular form of abuse?
Everyone is targeted by technology-facilitated gender-based violence, but we are also seeing that a group of women are specifically targeted because technology facilitated gender-based violence. It's obviously a strategy to silence women and to prevent women to enter in the public space and to have a discourse in the public space. Certain group of women are at higher risk of technology facilitated gender-based violence because of what they do, of who they are, or because they access a certain type of information. So specifically, when you look, you will think about politician, women journalists, women activists, women feminists, academician, and young people. And we know that those group of women are specifically targeted by that type of violence. And of those adolescents who do have access to digital technology, we know that 64% are high user and are particularly vulnerable to technology facilitated gender-based violence. And we know that the violence against women and girls is more frequent if they have disability, if they are racialized, if they are LGBTQIA+, if they are socioeconomically disadvantaged, and also if they are outspoken politically. We know that due to the gender divide in terms of access to technology, we know that young women and girls are less equipped as well to engage with digital. So in that sense, they are also more at risk of violence.
What's quite interesting is if you have a look at all boys bullying, it's different to how girls bully, because girls are insidious. They are catty, they're bitchy, they really are. Whereas the boys tend to be much more straightforward, far more direct.
The question of whether cyberbullying is a youth thing or whether it's across the different ages, I think, is a little bit simpler to answer. Yes, it is largely based on adolescence because of the amount of free time that they have and the amount of socializing that they do. Adults, we're using these devices more for work. Of course, there are lots of people that, you know, aren't working and do use them for just socializing or gaming and so on. But ultimately, the fact that the kids are living out their social lives online means that, you know, that's why the thrust of cyberbullying is happening in that area. Also, they lack the critical thinking skills and they lack the EQ skills to be able to self-regulate, stand outside themselves, you know, employ empathy, all of those types of things. You know, it takes time to develop those skills as a human. You know, we're not going to fully develop our critical thinking skills until the age of 25 when the prefrontal cortex is fully developed. So that means that you're literally hot on the button. You are impulsive. And those are the reasons why cyberbullying is most rife in the ages from, getting younger now, 11 and 12 up until, you know, early 20s.
Have I had my history in cyberbullying? Yes. And the reason why I felt like this touched me more is because I do have a history back in grade 9, like 4 years ago, where I myself was involved in a cyberbullying case and I was the perpetrator of this. And the sad thing about it is that I was perpetrating this harm and these hurtful words to people unaware that I was doing it, because I was coming from a place of so much scarcity and hurt that the school, I remember I even had to go to a disciplinary hearing for the school to let me aware of what I'm doing and what I was doing was wrong. I'll even give you an example of what I did. So in grade 9, a group of friends and I wrote a burn book of basically shaming girls in the whole grade. And what happened is we got into so much trouble for it. But the problem is at the time we were just looking at, we got into trouble, but we didn't really consider the harm and the damage it did to so many girls when those lists were published all over the internet on WhatsApp. They were published and the whole school had access to them. So it's just, I understand from the person who's doing it, and I also understand from the person who's experienced it, because I experienced it prior.
What is it that turns a person into a cyberbully? Shortly, the motivation can be informed by political and ideological agendas, or driven by revenge, anger, jealousy, sexual desire, or other similar factors.
One of the issues is that you never know who is who online. And so there is the big issue. And this is, you don't know, you have a profile, but you don't know who is behind that profile. But one of the things, you know, is that if you look on gender-based violence at overall, it's very clear that the perpetrator of gender-based violence, that men are disproportionately represented among the perpetrator of gender-based violence. So if you look at that and that you look at online space, you can really like imagine that the majority of the perpetrator are men as well. And you know, it's really like a way of silencing women. It's a way of preventing women to be vocal, to share their perspective, to be out there in the public space.
Like the person who physically abuses another, the personalities of both offenders includes natural abusive attitudes together with narcissism or even psychopathic behavior. GBV can be physical, sexual, emotional, financial, or structural, and can be perpetrated by intimate partners, acquaintances, or strangers. In the online space, GBV includes body shaming, threats of physical violence, and verbal abuse. And it's not limited to one sex against the other. All too often, females can be their own sex's worst enemy. Girls are more verbal than boys and more likely to use words to hurt than fists. Previous studies have found that girls are more likely to cyberbully than boys, while boys are more likely to be physical.
So I do find that it happens with both genders, especially guys sending out these hurtful messages to girls. Because what used to happen is that there used to be group chats circulating when the whole WhatsApp wave started back in grade 8. So what would happen is girls would send through their pictures and guys would immediately shame them, shame their body, shame how they look. And it's guys around our school back then. And they would basically body shame girls, basically say these hurtful stuff. And we never knew them, and no one knew who these guys were, but what they were saying would really affect the self-esteem of the girls, would really affect how they view themselves and how they feel about themselves, me personally included.
Cyberbullying isn't just guys trying to get girls to send compromising pictures or girls telling guys to go kill themselves, though. Sometimes girls can be a girl's worst enemy.
For me, cyberbullying really only was there when I was younger, more like a young teenager, about 15, 16. But obviously, as I've gotten older, it kind of stopped because people stop caring about you. But most of it had to do with appearance things and how I would show myself on social media, not in a provocative way, but I'll just post normal pictures and people would comment on my weight and say really mean things because I'm quite skinny. But none of it was really too hectic. Personally, I'd never gotten a comment from a boy over the internet, but in real life, obviously. But most of it was girls. Well, all of them were girls.
Cyberbullying is a multifaceted issue. However, the intention of this activity is one and the same: to hurt people and to bring them harm. Cyberbullying is not a light matter. It needs to be taken seriously as it does have a lot of dangerous effects on the victim. It also results in a lot of insecurities and complexes. The victim, which suffers cyberbullying in the form of harassment, starts having self-doubt. When someone points at your insecurities, they only tend to enhance them. Similarly, the victims worry and lose their inner peace. Other than that, cyberbullying also tarnishes the image of a person. It hampers their reputation with the false rumors spread about them. Everything on social media spreads like wildfire. Moreover, people often question the credibility. Thus, one false rumor can destroy people's lives.
I think the issue of naming and shaming is one of the biggest issues that I deal with. It's obviously a very nuanced and multi-layered issue. You know, we've seen naming and shaming in the adult age groups. We've seen the emergence of the hashtag MeToo movement internationally, the hashtag AmINext movement in South Africa. We've seen a lot of naming and shaming around racism, around the Black Lives Matter movement. What we saw at schools, particularly in the middle of 2020, was huge, almost digital vigilantism, and I don't use the word vigilantism necessarily negatively, but kids really taking matters into their own hands, naming and shaming teachers, naming and shaming their fellow learners at schools. And in some instances, it was maybe warranted and sometimes legally defensible. And in many instances, it wasn't. Naming and shaming invariably is defamation. So if you defame somebody, then you need to be able to show that what you've said is protected by a defense.
I think it is easier for people to bully behind a phone screen, whatever you want to say, because they aren't saying it to your face. Because a lot of people who are bullies don't have the courage to actually say those things in front of you, and they find it easier to do it, well, you could say behind your back, but behind the phone screen because they don't have to confront it in real life. They can just hide behind whoever they want to be on the internet. But then you do get those few who are confident enough to say it to your face and on the internet. But I think the people who do it over the phone are more hectic than the people who say it to your face because they can say whatever they want and they feel that there won't be any repercussions.
It's way easier to hide behind the cell phone because you have no one physically here confronting you. And it gives you so much more confidence knowing that you're behind a screen and you're far away from everybody. However, if it were in person, you'd be much more scared because they would physically confront you or, in any case, correct you for it in person.
How do you protect yourself against cyberbullying in the first place? Do you lessen your social media presence?
I'd say it made me feel pretty insecure because the things that they commented on, I was already insecure about. I felt pretty worthless at a stage. I think after a while, I just kind of started to ignore it and it just started to become part of the daily life. Like you would just wait for them to come and you kind of just get over it. You can't really stop people from being mean, especially if they want to be mean to make themselves feel better. You can't really do anything to stop them doing it, but to stop it happening to you through social media, try not to post too much of your life and very personal things because it's always out there. Block people when you see the first one come. Just block them so they can't get hold of you anymore. Filter out the people who follow you or you follow. So for instance, I only follow 160 people because I don't want to see everyone's lives. And I don't reply to any requested messages from people, even if they are positive or negative, because there's a reason why I don't follow them. Just be a kind person.
I wouldn't say that girls should not post their pictures on social media because in its essence, social media is about sharing your pictures, about sharing your lifestyle with people who care about you and people who are close to you. So social media shouldn't be limited because of certain individuals who want to say harmful and hurtful things. So I don't think that girls or anybody in general should stop posting their pictures because they're afraid of some people sending out hurtful messages. We should just create a much safer cyberspace so that such things don't happen.
The UNFPA has come up with a way to help end online abuse and digital violence by claiming your body right, a campaign that gives people a brand new copyright for the human body. It demands that images of our bodies are given the same respect and protection online as copyright gives to music, film, and even corporate logos. Because right now, corporate logos and copyrighted IP receive greater protection online than we do as human beings.
UNFPA set up the Body Right. It was launched last year. It's the Body Right campaign. And you know, it was really like a campaign that was put in place to push government and technology company to take the lead in halting digital violence. And you know, that campaign really calls to legislators, journalists, civil society, and really those with influence to speak out and stand up and take action. Because when you look today, you know that today women around the world currently have fewer ways to protect themselves online than copyrighted intellectual property. So violating a copyright can result in immediate removal of material and criminal and civil penalties. And women and girls facing the non-consensual sharing of the image should really have even more vigorous protection. So it was really like coming from that perspective. That campaign really asks for several things. The first one, it's really about legal framework legislation. We need legal framework policies that adequately protect human rights online, including the right to live free from violence, to have freedom of expression, access information, and the right to privacy and data protection. So we need legislation and policy framework that ensure that. We also need to have much more investment in survivor-centered and feminist-informed response mechanisms that address all forms of technology facilitate gender-based violence, looking at isolated incidents, but also really looking at those that are part of a pattern of a behavior. So we need to engage with school, we need to engage with community, advocate, and we need to really strengthen data security to ensure effective prevention. The other element is that when we look at the data and the evidence that is available on technology-facilitated gender-based violence, it really shows us that we need to understand much more the extent of technology-facilitated gender-based violence. So we need to invest in data and research to be able to really inform policy and a legal framework to better protect women and girls, survivors of technology-facilitated gender-based violence. And then we really need to have private technology companies, service providers, women in all the diversity, scholar national governments that needs to really inform effective and immediate safety mechanisms. We need to have really strong mechanisms in place that respond and protect women and girls to be really free of violence online and offline.
The solution to something like cyberbullying is going to require a huge amount of attention and effort from not just the students, it comes from the adults. That's why in our program at My Social Life, we teach the teachers, the parents, the mental health professionals, and the students. So that means that we can approach the problem in four different ways. So to be very specific, the first thing that we need to do with the students themselves is to fully show them just what they might not really be seeing about their own use and the virality, the publicness, the always on aspect of this phone dinging and pinging in your school bag or in your back pocket that's always alerting you to some type of information, which can be positive, can be e-learning, can be exciting aspects around sport or art or anything. But it also can be, you know, the drama that's going down on social. So we first of all say to them, do you understand just the extent of the tentacles that reach out from this device and these social platforms? Then do you understand the impact as those tentacles reach out and grab around somebody who is the unwilling victim of a situation? Then we say to them, well, do you understand what it might be like to be unable to unlock yourself from the tight grasp of that tentacle? You literally cannot cut yourself loose. And now you're at the beck and call of a whole load of people who are sharing your information or, you know, outing you for something that you may have done mistakenly online, and you have absolutely no control. It's literally run. I say in Sendry, it's run like wildfire away from you, and you just start watching it. And then we say, well, how would you feel then if that happened to you? And that is the hardest part, is that it's difficult for kids to be able to drop down into themselves and to be able to make that connection, because you need to really stop. You almost need to close your eyes and you need to think about the times in which you have felt shame. That's difficult. When do you get that time? Who wants to close their eyes in an assembly hall? You have to think about it. You have to make a deeper connection. And we have to unpack all of this. Now, that's just the students. So what we want to do is, you know, we want the students to make that connection. We want them to start to understand what empathy is, and we want to help them to be able to employ it. And that takes real time. You know, there needs to be a lot of work on EQ and empathy. I mean, a lot of the teachers and students say to us that, you know, what's really strange is that we find that it's really difficult for kids to be able to make a connection to their actual feelings. Like, job number one is, what am I feeling? And therefore, we call it the ABCs. Therefore, what is my behavior? The A is the antecedent, like what happens before. Then B, what is my behavior? And C is what is the consequence of my behavior on somebody else. D would then be, I don't know what the D stands for. D would then be, how do I employ empathy? Maybe that's the E. I need to think about a good D. And so that really starts to help. There are consequences, and you can tackle the situation by going to law enforcement and going to a lawyer. But what then happens, as we know with the law, is that it takes time and that you get dragged along with that situation, which essentially gives it more life, more longevity, when you just wish this whole situation would go away. So yes, you do want to tackle it, but what you really need to do, number one, is to have sufficient proof, and you need to then protect yourself. So gather proof and then block and get away from. Find your champion and say, I need the help. But if you need the help and you haven't got the proof, and you're still sitting inside that environment with that person, you failed at step one and two before you went off to go and get the legal help. You have to collate enough information, and then you have to, as I say, seek the right counsel, and then you have to make sure that you're detached from this person. And sadly, there's a fourth. You need to be a little bit careful about how your own behavior looks online. If you've got a large public account with 32,000 followers and you've said some things which weren't so cool, it's quite difficult, because this then becomes a case which gets proposed between antagonist and victim, and it can be shifted to be the other way.
With the Body Right campaign, it's really like about how young people, women survivor, allies can really use the message of the Body Right campaign to engage at the level, asking and demanding for change at the government level, at the private sector, a private company level, really taking the Body Right campaign as an opportunity to speak about technological facilitated gender-based violence, to really speak about it, starting a discussion. And especially if I look at young women, because we know that young women are the ones that are disproportionately affected by gender-based violence, but also we know that they are more online, so they are more at risk as well of technology-facilitated gender-based violence. So it's also for them to kind of take that campaign as the opportunity to really speak about the issue that they are facing online, and to really create that kind of movement with others about demanding for change at different levels. At individual level, at governmental level, but also with the social media platform and the tech company.
60% of young people have witnessed online bullying. Most do not intervene.
I didn't go to someone who I thought could help, because at first I didn't think it was a big deal. I thought it was just something that happens to everyone, which it kind of does, but... And because I didn't want people to see the thing that affected me most, which was my weight. I didn't want people to think that I had a weight issue. And then also, I didn't want to make the people around me feel bad for me, because I was already in a bad place. I didn't want them to pity me even more. And also because I don't think that anyone could have helped. When I was cyberbullied, I didn't go to many people or people who, in a way, could make a difference on the bigger scheme of things. But I did go to my best friend to just show her what was going on, because it affected me quite a lot, and she was asking why it affected me like that. So I went to her, but that didn't really help. Well, it helped me cope, but it didn't really help fix the situation. I did question for a while if I should tell someone, because I felt that it was my fault that it was happening, even though I didn't do anything. But my best friend did confront the person at school who was doing it, and it didn't help. It just got worse from there.
The other part of it is that we want people to understand that it's really important to not join in. They have some choices. They can either watch the circus, they can leave the watching of the circus and leave the big marquee and not have any part of it. They can stand up against the bully, which is being an upstander, which is very difficult because the bully might come after you. And number four, and this is for me the most important one, is that you go up to the person, or you text them, or you WhatsApp them, or you call them, and you say to them, "Are you okay? I see you. That's brutal. This is problematic. How can I help you? But let me take your lead on how we do this." Because people step across the bow of these situations. They kind of dig in, get involved, and then they cause more problems. So the first thing is, you need to go in and see the person, and you need to identify that it's unacceptable and that you've got them. You don't even need to tackle the bully. That can save a life, because it's the isolation that causes this massive problem. So you've got to get close to the person. Okay, this is problematic. I'm not happy about this. How do we deal with this? Who do you think that we could tell? Who do we trust? Who's our champion? But I've got you, and I'm going to keep an eye out for you. Just having somebody by your side is absolutely instrumental. You see, I'm just talking about the kids now. Now I'm going to talk about the teachers. The teachers need to understand that they themselves, for example, can set this problem on fire. Because what they often do is they say, "Hey, you two, come here. Okay, now you've got the bully, and now you've got the victim." But the victim is so terrified of the bully, they're not going to say anything. And later on, public, viral, always on, This is coming at them on their phone. This is the difference between my generation and this generation is when we got home, I was able to breathe. And even if I didn't tell anybody, I would be able to hide inside the TV. But actually, the dinging and the pinging of my phone has this viral situation going down. And I don't really know what people are thinking of me. And now my head's being done in and so on. So teachers need to handle this really sensitively. It's a new landscape. Parents need to look for the signals about what's going on. Is there a change in behavior? Am I noticing something that is strange about their level of attention, level of sleep, level of communicating? Is there some aggression, depression, anxiety? And that's really, really difficult because we have kids that are already going through adolescence where, you know, there are all sorts of biological and neurobiological changes anyway. At the best of times, you know, my daughter loves to sleep late. How am I going to tell? You know, this is like so complicated. But we need to also get the parents to understand what apps and what platforms. Do they know whether there's an AMA app on there? Do they know how their kids are conversing? Do they have bad influences inside their friend groups online? Sure.
So I think as ordinary person, we are all the time online, we are on the different social media platform. So really like the first thing as an individual, it's really like call out the violence when we see it happening, calling out the person perpetrating the violence, but also reporting the person perpetrating the violence. And also an element very important, it's to really play that role of accompanying the survivor. So really also being there online with the survivor, telling her what is happening, that violence is happening, that you are seeing it, and also that you are there also to support her. We have different roles to play, calling the perpetrator, really calling out the social media platform, really showing what is happening, but also being there for the survivor.
So from the person who's experiencing it, I feel like the first thing that I wish I'd done before was speak to somebody. So speak to anybody, even if it's my mother or my cousin, but just let it out. Because what happens is when you bury a lot of hurt and pain inside, you end up bringing it out and it ends up becoming an outburst. So speaking to someone about it, because it's more than just someone saying hurtful words to you. However, it's also a psychological thing that happens within you. And it also it starts affecting your self-esteem. It starts affecting your whole confidence. The first thing I'd advise people to do is speak to somebody. Reach out to somebody, anybody. And the best thing is to speak to somebody who doesn't know you. So maybe like a school psychologist who can really understand what you're going through and not assess your character first and then compare it to the situation. So somebody who will just focus on what you're going through, because it really does require attention.
Only 1 in 10 teen victims will inform a parent or trusted adult of their abuse.
The percentage of parents that are aware of their kids being bullied online, in my experience, is somewhere between about 5 to 6 out of 10, 50 to 60%, because the students themselves tell us in our program, and remember, this is thousands of students ranging from 9 to 10 years old and 16 and 17 years old. They put their hands up and say, there is no way I would share this information with my parents. Why? Number one, embarrassment. Number two, I feel shame inside myself. Number three, I don't want to disappoint them. Number four, I fear their wrath and that they're going to. Number five, this is the key one, take my device away. There's a consequence either internally in how you're going to feel about yourself inside that family system. You know, it's how you would feel internally, but also what the external punishment would be. Because what's happening is some parents are completely overreacting. They too themselves have their own anxieties, insecurities, and fears. And when they hear that their most precious connection in the entire world, their child, is suffering, it takes a huge amount to be able to self-regulate yourself and approach this with real care, calm, and a very balanced view, you know. And what's happening is our emotions get the better of us, and so therefore we say, right, I'm going to go and tackle this with the school, or I'm going to take your phone away, and the child doesn't feel like they're winning. And what we always say to the kids is, here's the deal. When you do want to share something with your parents, number one, sit them down. You're going to surprise them. Number two, say to them, look, I'm coming to you when I don't want to come to you about this. And number three is, when I do start telling you about this, you need to understand that you might freak out. And if you do, I might run for the hills and not want to share this with you in the future. In other words, you disarm the parent from their own emotional overreaction, because you're basically saying, I'm coming to you and I'm reaching out this trust branch in this very tricky area for me. I need you to come to the party on your side of the deal.
Well, the type of person who doesn't like changing things that happened in the past, because it makes you who you are. But if I did change something back then, probably speaking to my mom about it, because she's pretty hardcore. So I think she would have helped me a lot. But also just thinking about it more and working through it more mentally to help myself be in a better mental headspace.
There are different categories of who kids can speak to if they're being cyberbullied. And again, I'm a little bit more disruptive because I'm on the ground teaching these kids in schools and creating content and hearing their feedback. So I see it a little bit differently, where normally it would be suggested that students would go to an organization, say like a Childline or a Bully Stop, and so on. And I would definitely say, absolutely, that is your first port of call. Go and get help from the number one professional that deals with this particular issue. And there are many different issues online. But for bullying, you would want to be going to a Childline, a depression and South African depression and anxiety group, say, for this particular country, you know, to other anti-bullying specialists in your country, wherever you may be. It's very, very easy. You're going to go to anti-bullying plus the name of your country, and those organizations will come up. It's really that simple. However, the difficulty, and this is the reason why I'm a little bit more controversial, is that it's very difficult. It invokes a lot of fear for us to be able to then go and call a complete and utter stranger and expose ourselves to that person. If a child doesn't want to do that because of being overwhelmed with fear or shame, we need to start with, who do you trust? And is the person that you trust truly trustworthy? Because sometimes kids are trusting friends who they deem to be friends, but actually those friends have not proven themselves to be friends. Their track record is not good. So you go to them and say, I'm having this problem, but then that person betrays your trust and your situation amplifies. That's not what you want. We always say to them, you have to choose that person that is your champion so, so carefully. And that's why choosing a friend sometimes is your first choice, but maybe not your best choice. You really need to choose your parent, but you need to prep your parent so that your parent doesn't spin out and lose you. You could choose your sibling, but make sure it's a tight sibling. Because if it's a sibling that you often fight with, perhaps that might be used against you. Maybe your own sibling bullies you in some instances. So in my opinion, what they need to do is they need to find that champion that will truly take them on the journey towards the solution. And they need to take time over it. They need to think about it. You know, that's why we train all, we request that we train all the teachers in the school. And often schools say, no, just train the LO or the IT teacher. And I'm like, no. Because what if the maths teacher's the champion and he doesn't understand that there's a thing called QME out there? We've blown it. We've literally blown this thing. We had a child reach out for help and the maths teacher says, look, and I hear this a lot, I'm the maths teacher. This is not my gig. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. You were holding the bridge to be able to help this child walk across towards a solution. You may not have to solve it, but you need to listen first. You need to then say, wow, this is serious. Because I think a lot of adults see cyberbullying as something that's very typical of adolescence. Yes, bullying is typical of adolescence. Doesn't make it any less severe that it happened then and every decade since. With regard to cyberbullying, it's this ability that it can run out of your control that can tip people over the edge. You know, physical bullying is limited to the fact that if you stay at home, you're not going to get bullied again. unless they called you 20 years ago. It could be over. You could change school. But even if you change school, someone can still come and get you online. And they do. They create catfish accounts and then they keep getting you because they can see that you're vulnerable and they are allowed to assert their dominance. So for me, what we need to do is we need to teach kids about first of all, being able to communicate, to be able to connect with the level of harm that this is creating them, because sometimes it can be dusted away. And then to be able to say, well, I must reach out for help. Now, where do I go? The place that they need to go to is the next person that can take them to the best service provider, which would be, for example, a mental health therapist, or perhaps a place like Childline, which are absolute experts in it. And I'm going to go back and just say one more thing, which is that I do believe that those places are the best places to go. I'm just not sure they're the first place that children will go to. It's a huge leap to go from being bullied and harmed and to have your self-esteem smashed apart to then go, oh, I'm going to pick up a phone to an anonymous chat line. You're going to go to the closest place that you think that might just save you, and that hopefully that person, if chosen right, will then be able to get you to the next place. That's my view.
If your child has been a victim of conduct online, content online, then the first step I would say is to educate yourself. The first line of defense for all of this is active, involved, engaged, aware parents. Have a look at the Digital Law Academy if you need to have a quick refresher course on what legal options are available to you. And then get in touch with somebody who specializes in this kind of area.
Cyberbullying is not just an adolescent problem, though. Adults can be victims too. If this surprises you, just look at the comments on any social media of celebrities, athletes, politicians, or public figures, and you'll see a prime example of online harassment by adults and between adults.
You know, the one thing I will say is that in our program, we show it's really amazing. So the biggest standing ovation kids get out of their seats for this is I show a video, and it starts with all these young kids, and it's got this really cool soundtrack, and it just shows you all these kids. Like, it looks like pictures from that, I don't know, 70s, 80s, 90s. And then at the halfway point, the music kind of slows, and then it starts again. It shows exactly the same kids later on in life. And they are all some of the most famous people in the world. So it's Bill Clinton, Rihanna, Tom Cruise, Duchess Kate Middleton, very famous Charlize, and underneath it they say, I was bullied until the very last day of school. And the place just goes absolutely quiet, and then they get up and they often start clapping. And we always say to them, you've got to remember that one of the reasons why you are bullied is because you are, there's a certain uniqueness about you that is very difficult for people to handle.
When the internet opened the door for communities and individuals to connect, discrimination, hate speech, and virtual human rights violations became the uninvited guests. This included the door for sexual harassment and violence against women to not only be opened, but to reveal an entire other world of assault and psychological attacks that the law enforcement facilities and the governments around the world, quite simply, were not prepared for.
The consequence for bullies, unfortunately, is not significant enough because of the underestimation of what cyberbullying is and can do to an individual. So I'm going to quickly answer that, and then I'm going to get into to why. But if we understand what cyberbullying is, that it can be ongoing, that it can create mental and emotional harm that can be long-lasting because it can erode your self-esteem. It can, in extreme cases, be traumatic, you know, have that seed that is really difficult to get out of your deeper conscious, your subconscious. Then that is essentially a tattoo that can be on your skin for a very long part of your life. So for that reason, we need to understand that this is not just bullying. For some kids, from some recipients, it can have a very indelible mark. And so therefore, we need to understand that the consequence, there needs to be more of a zero tolerance around a bullying, not something that's like many, many shades of grey. It needs to be a little bit more towards black and white, and trying to build a school culture or a digital culture in which this certain thing cannot be tolerated because it's not part of who we are. The problem is trying to prove it is a whole other question. But in terms of consequence, it's not significant enough because it is really difficult to understand the depth. It's quite invisible, the depth of harm. It's quite difficult to track who is culpable because bullies are really good at covering their tracks. They delete a lot of their posts immediately. And a lot of it is done outside of school, and it's done at night, for example. So it's just so, so difficult to track. But when kids do get caught, what we do see is that schools are then find themselves in a situation where we go, okay, do we give this student a debit or a demerit or whatever you want to call it? Do we put them in detention? I'm not even sure about detention these days, where that sits in the school system. Do we suspend them or do we expel them? The consequence to doing different levels of that incurs different levels of anger and defense from the parent. And then it opens a whole story, which then means that the child is trapped in the situation again, where there's a bully and two families. And what it requires, I'm about to get to the solution, is what it requires is the sensitivity about victim and antagonism. You know, what is actually happening in that dynamic? What will happen if we handle it badly? What type of individual has the conflict resolution skills to be able to attend to this situation and create some type of healing? The type of individual that understands bullying and what the dynamics are, and to be able to bring the appropriate people in at the right time to deliver the desired outcome. What I'm basically saying is, it's incredibly difficult, because which school has time to attend to, okay, let's find out. First of all, let's do forensics on what actually happened here. Then we have to come to a conclusion about what the issue is. Can it be solved and healed? Can we get people to support the situation so that it does or doesn't happen? Which individuals can track whether it is or isn't happening, be it teachers or parents at home? How do we get kids to talk and so on? And what it really requires is somebody inside the school to be able to take a greater interest in conflict resolution.
To get a better idea of the legalities surrounding the issue, we spoke to a leading expert in social media law, Emma Sadler. Having been a legal resource for many journalists over the years, the advent of new communications and the concomitant ways of skirting the laws or visiting harm on others became Emma's focus.
In my business, I do a whole range of things, a lot of educational work, a lot of crisis response work. I do a lot of work around image-based violence, revenge pornography, sextortion. I still get at least 5 phone calls a day from people who've been sextorted. So somebody you've met online and they win your trust and then they solicit naked pictures out of you and then they start asking for money or they threaten to share that content. It happens across the board, all ages, all races, all sexualities. And it's something that I have to deal with really on a daily basis. My clients weren't journalists anymore. They were ordinary people finding themselves in huge amounts of trouble, sometimes victims of online harms. And I realized that there was a specific need for education and for a focused practice on the kinds of issues that kids are dealing with. So the biggest issues that I deal with at every school are cyberbullying and sexting. And often the sexting leads to cyberbullying. And I think it's really trying to get the message out and the appreciation that cyberbullying is a very, very extreme form of violence. And it is something that we should be taking seriously. You know, it's I would say, worse than traditional bullying, because it is faceless, so the content is worse. It's sometimes anonymous, And it's relentless, the torment of 24/7 bullying, something that can't be escaped even when the kids leave school and go home for the night or for the weekend. What we see happening, particularly with the youth, is a lot of kids jumping on the bandwagon. So one person will name and shame, and then everybody jumps on the bandwagon. Often it's well reported. The response to some sort of bad behavior where somebody's been named and shamed, the response is even worse than the original behavior. We see death threats, we see rape threats, we see doxing, we see people having to go into hiding, change their names, all sorts of things happening when they've been named and shamed.
Flaming, it comes back to that nuance. The difference between trolling and shaming is trolling's just out and out, like, I'm going to say horrible stuff to you. Okay, so it's an aggressive out and out comment. Mm-hmm. Flaming is when you're almost trying to gaslight somebody. You are flaming, you're antagonizing, you're inflaming a situation by subtly poking the bear, saying things which get people really riled up. So, for example, you could say something which we'd see on an app like QMe, that's QOOH.me, QMe, which is an anonymous chat function. There's many of them. They all sit inside a family of apps called AMA apps, Ask Me Anything apps, perfect for flaming. That means that nobody knows who you are. They don't know your photo. They don't know your name. They can do if you put it in, but most people don't because they love the anonymity. And you can say something like, X person said to me that you have slept with Y person. That's flaming. Maybe completely untrue. You're now beautifully veiled by the curtain of anonymity. And then you can just spike somebody to start to get anxious, angry. You try and get them riled up. So you're inflaming somebody's anger, sadness, anxiety, even their self-harm activity. And some people want to get you to start doing these certain types of behaviors, whatever they are. You can go into a self-harm app. There are these forums on apps like, I don't want to quote one actually, because I sometimes get them mixed up, whether it might be Calm Harm or My3. But ultimately, you can go into these apps, which should be safe spaces, but you can find trolls and flamers who are in there who are saying things to people who already are self-harming, and that can trigger their self-harm. It's really crazy, the open gates of the internet. And as I said, I've gone in through Instagram accounts and then down into like a community of people on QMe. Often it will be people within a grade, for example. I can go in and I can understand so much of the dynamics about students purely. I may not know their names, but I can see the dynamics of a certain grade of students, let's say 100 students, by the nature of what's going down there. And in there, I see kids say, why don't you just go and kill yourself? Nobody wants you here at this school. And that sounds like I'm trying to be incendiary myself. And I really pride us on trying not to be fear-mongers, because I really believe that we're sitting at an intersection where kids can use the net positively. They can actually exercise their digital potential by showing them what their potential is online, showing them the entrepreneurial potential of using these apps in a different way. So I'm trying to direct people to potential and away from the AMA apps, which is very difficult because that's where our curiosity lies. And I say that because when I say these things, like somebody says, why don't you go and kill yourself? I think I often hear adults go, really, but how much? I'm like, well, it doesn't really matter how much. It's the fact that we've got young humans that are making people feel so isolated that they can and do commit suicide based upon what's happening online. And we see that. We've seen that in the instances of the country that I live in Southern Africa. And that is extremely problematic, that a life can be taken or a life can be lost due to people not understanding the impact of their actions online.
I do think that girls who are being bullied would consider self-harm, because I know when I was getting like that, I did self-harm to a certain extent, nothing deep, but because you kind of get numb when people say things about you and you want to feel something. It's also an outlet for pain. You don't want to speak about it to someone, but you need an outlet to deal with it. So I definitely think a lot of people do that.
So for me, the most affecting work that I do is this trend of bullying, which I have termed encouragement to suicide. Just go kill yourself. Go jump off a cliff. No one likes you anyway. And it's just the most unthinkable message that you could imagine your child receiving. There in South Africa is a sort of a confused legal response to it. Certainly if somebody infringes your dignity, you could lay a criminal charge against that person. If you threaten somebody with damage to their property or threaten somebody with violence, that is a criminal offense. If you incite violence, now whether that's violence against yourself, we're not sure yet because the Cybercrimes Act is so brand new. But what I can tell you from an international point of view is that there are cases emerging around the world, particularly in America. So when it comes to encouragement to suicide, there is an international trend towards holding the person sending the data messages, telling that person to commit suicide, self-harm, responsible for what happens to that person. So I'm thinking of the case of Michelle Carter and Conrad Roy. Michelle Carter at the time was 15 years old, sent text messages to her boyfriend at the time, a guy called Conrad Roy, telling him to commit suicide, quite detailed instructions on how to do it. He had had depression and had thought about suicide, and she kind of encouraged him. What happened in that case was that she was held responsible for his death. Now, if you told me 10 years ago that we'd be getting to the position that that would happen, that you could be held responsible for somebody's death, having not even been in the same state as them, I wouldn't have believed you. But given the kinds of content that I see landing up in my inbox, I understand why the law is going in that direction. And I think it's actually something that we should welcome if it does hit our shores, because children need to understand, everybody needs to understand that what you send in a message is not just words. That can be serious violence.
So just how does cyberbullying relate to gender-based violence? Surely the two are disparate, as violence is something that is physically harming a person. Mostly it comes into play when there has been a relationship between the people involved. Online gender-based violence is similar to online harassment, cyberbullying, and cybersexism, but the latter terms are not gender-specific. Gender-based violence differs from these because of the attention it draws to discrimination and online violence targeted specifically because of their gender, most frequently those who identify as female.
I'll use an example like gender-based violence. So it is something that many people have their own views on it, and many people have their own perceptions of what it is and what it shouldn't be. So what happens is online, since it's not face-to-face type of situation, people feel as though they can just attack people and also use quite triggering words and statements and not realizing the harm that it's doing on other people. So I have had a lot of people come onto my podcast, speak about cyberbullying and their experiences, but it hasn't been direct as in like, today we're speaking about cyberbullying. However, it does flow into the conversation.
A United Nations report indicates that cyberviolence is just as damaging to women and girls as physical violence, and estimates that 73% of women have endured cyberviolence and are 27 times more likely than men to be harassed online. Emerging data shows that women and girls are subjected to various forms of gender-based cyber online violence. This refers to online behavior targeting women and girls, intending to intimidate, to coerce, or to cause fear, anxiety, humiliation, and extreme emotional distress. The Principles of African Declaration also emphasize that women and girls should have the right to access to information online, the right to access to affordable internet, and the right to due process. Yet, from this report, it is clear that the majority of women and girls' digital rights were violated.
So there's a whole range of people who've been the victim of an online harm. There are a whole range of legal options that are available to victims. We have quite traditionally the law of defamation. So if somebody hurts your reputation, you can sue for defamation. If somebody hurts your dignity, a serious infringement of your dignity, you can go and lay a criminal charge against that person. That would be the crime of crimen injuria. And we're seeing the more extreme cases of cyberbullying, victims doing that, going to lay criminal charges. It is something that I think should be used more frequently, infringement of dignity, crimen injuria. We've seen it in cyberbullying cases. We've also seen it in doxing cases. So, for example, Oyanda Mbuli laid criminal charges against somebody who shared her cell phone number online and said, please, can somebody go and find her a blesser? And also said that she was a stupid beep. And she laid criminal injuria charges, and that person was successfully prosecuted. So criminal injuria is quite a sort of generic offense. We can use it in all sorts of instances. We also use it for victims of revenge pornography, image-based violence. Anytime your dignity is infringed, it can be racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, xenophobia. It is a very helpful criminal offense. We've also just had President Ramaphosa at the beginning of December, in December 2021, announced that the Cyber Crimes Act is just about entirely in effect. Now, what that does is it specifically criminalizes messages, any kind of data message. It can be a tweet, it can be a DM, it can be a Facebook message, it can be a voice note, it can be a video. Any data message which incites damage to property or which incites violence to a person or group of persons. We've seen a lot of that sort of incitement kind of crime earlier this year. But it also could very well be in the sort of vigilantism, digital vigilantism, mass mobilization of causing harm to somebody in a vigilante kind of a way. The other thing that the Cyber Crimes Act does that it criminalizes a threat. So if you threaten a person with damage to their property, or if you threaten a person with violence, so if I send a message saying I'm going to beat you up, or I'm going to murder you, or I'm going to burn your house down, just the sending of that message becomes a specific criminal offense. The Cyber Crimes Act also criminalizes the non-consensual distribution of intimate images. So we're making steps towards trying to govern from a legal point of view some of the harms that we see online. A victim of cyberbullying who comes to me, I would say the first step would be to get a protection order under the Protection from Harassment Act. It's actually nicknamed the Cyberbullying Act, and it allows you to get a protection order against anybody who is causing you harm or a fear of harm. It can be threatening, stalking, bullying behavior. It can be all sorts of things. Any person who is using an electronic device to cause you harm, or threatening to cause you harm in the real world, can get a protection order under the Protection from Harassment Act.
In a sense, I feel like for individuals, for example, I use men who ask for inappropriate pictures from women online or those type of things, I feel like that already is dangerous enough. So if we speak about gender-based violence, and these are men that you know who have access to all of this, it could happen where situations occur where they threaten you with these images of sharing all of these images. So in a sense, I do believe that cyberbullying can contribute to gender-based violence, but to a certain extent, because I feel like it's much deeper than just bullying online.
In short, online gender-based violence is a form of gender injustice and discrimination that takes place in online spaces. It forms part of online violence, which is an umbrella term used to describe all sorts of illegal or harmful behaviors against women in the online space. They can be linked to experiences of violence in real life or be limited to the online environment only. They can include illegal threats, stalking or incitement to violence, unwanted offensive or sexually explicit emails or messages, sharing of private images or videos without consent, or inappropriate advances on social networking sites. Although most people don't see cyberbullying as gender-based violence, as it's done at a remove, not up close and personal, it's how it ultimately can affect a person where the two are linked. Violence doesn't mean just bodily harm. It's also mental or emotional abuse, a violation of the spirit, which can ultimately lead to physical harm.
The best piece of advice that I could give to the young women of Africa with respect to intimidation, harassment, cyberbullying, exposure to all forms of abuse online, is that you hold the key and you can stand guard at the door of your mind and of your heart simply by turning your phone off, by blocking people, by choosing to click on the right content, because if you click on the wrong content, It's going to feed you more of that content based upon the algorithm. And the, let's call it the engine of social media, sends you more of what you click on. And the importance is that a brief pause to just think about something and work out whether it's something that serves you, that's going to take you forward, whether that friend that you connect with is good for you, whether that thing that you click on or the thing that you say is something that's positive, that can take you towards the potential that you actually have deep inside you, why you were put on this planet. Because the internet is so deeply distracting and ever-evolving and explosive that it's going to bombard you with people and comments and, alongside the positivity, a lot of negativity. We live in a violent environment. We live with a lot of divisiveness. We live where people feel it's okay to antagonize and shame and say whatever they like behind the curtain of anonymity. And the ultimate power that we have is to be able to say no. Now, if we can't say no verbally because it's so hard to find that courage deep inside us, that maybe we don't even have that courage because we've been knocked about a bit in life, that we do have the silent power to disengage, to turn our phones off, to delete an account, to block a person, to pursue better positive friendships, content. You can stand guard at the door of your mind, and it will pay you lifelong dividends to keep your own algorithm, your own mind space, carefully guarded about what's going in and what's coming out of your mouth and on your posts, so that you can keep moving towards more positive outcomes. If you think that you have tens of thousands of thoughts a day, you have to be careful about what's coming through the eyes and through the ears, because it's being stored. And then when you type or publish a photo, whatever's stored here is changing the lens of the way in which you see the world outside. So if you're feeling negative inside because of what you see, you can be negative outside. That's going to stunt your growth and your potential. And as somebody that has daughters, and as somebody that comes from a single parent family brought up by my mother, I have a great affinity with young women, and I have great passion for their rights and where they want to go. But the hardest part is to know right at the beginning that the main step that you take is the choices that you make and the way in which you safeguard yourself offline and online.
It is important to note that online violence often accompanies, precedes, or escalates into offline violence, and protection should therefore include the same protection given to victims or survivors of offline violence, such as the provision of shelters and issuing of restraining orders. If you're being harassed or bullied online, what can you do?
First of all, it's not about you, because 99% of the time, the person who is writing these things or sharing these things online is coming from a place of scarcity, coming from a place of hurt, coming up from a place of loneliness, and just from a place where they are miserable in their own lives. So when they share these things, it's not about you. It's about what they're going through. So I wouldn't say just cut it out, because it's not easy to just block it all out, because some words are really just hurtful. But what I would say is just understand that sometimes things are not about you, but what the other person is going through. And it helps you understand the person more, because maybe it's just a cry for help.
Online GBV is especially dangerous because a lot of online spaces do not have enough rules and regulations to protect women from this type of violence, which leads to perpetrators often not facing consequences for their harmful actions.
Technology companies are a critical ally in the sense that they can really put in place mechanisms that will make sure that women and girls are protected from technology-facilitated gender-based violence. So really, like, looking at data security, looking at mechanisms that really prevent the abuse, and specifically gender-targeted abuse.
I don't know what it is. Only maybe you know what it is. And we literally say, when you lie in bed at night and you look at the ceiling and There can be all the noise coming through your ears about what that person said about you. You do know that deep inside you, there are amazing things. You could love dogs. Doesn't matter, really, because a girl teen's love of a pet is so central to everything that we do all year. They just talk about their pets the whole time and food. And what's amazing is we show them this and we say, it is difficult to be unique because the other people are a little bit less sensitive. They can't see as much in the room as you can, which means that your teens are harder. You may be a bit more anxious. You may be a bit more sensitive. You may take in a lot more information. And that may make you a little bit more overwhelmed or a little bit more vulnerable. Or maybe you're just extra clever and you're bloody genius and everyone's jealous of you. Or you're hot. You know, they often like laugh. Or you're, you know, it doesn't matter where you are. You can be the most sporty person and you can get bullied. But ultimately, when that triggers the vulnerability in other people, and it triggers their fear and their insecurity and so on, then you can understand that that's why they behave. It doesn't make it completely excusable at all. But it means that somewhere in the journey of your life going forward, there's two things. You will be more resilient despite feeling more hurt because you having to experience it all the time. And when you understand that this journey is hard, but your later journey will likely be easier because of what you can see, what you have felt, what you have survived, and which party, which group of unique individuals you sit with, the great people, then there's incredible hope. And when you're being bullied, you need hope because it rapidly dwindles. You get yourself into a corner and it's hideous, it's dark, and it's terrible. So I've had anxiety since, funnily enough, now that I teach it, I hardly have it. But I had anxiety pretty much in my early teens into kind of OCD, like very, very hard, very difficult. That's why I understand it so deeply. And so I can talk about sitting in darkness and I can talk about overwhelm and I can talk about panic disorder and I can talk about like, you know, not being understood and thinking you're weird and everything. And it's great. My worst days turned out to be my best stuff.
Cyberbullying prevention is the need of the hour. It needs to be monitored and put an end to. There are various ways to tackle cyberbullying, and we can implement them at individual levels as well as authoritative levels. It is critical we make the link between vicious online harassment and cyberbullying and real-life violence against women.
UNFPA has been putting in place several ways of really looking at gender-based violence prevention and response. And as UNFPA, one of the critical areas where we work, it's really like to ensure that women and girls live in a world free of gender-based violence. So you can contact UNFPA in the country where you are to really ask for who is providing prevention and response services. So if you are a survivor of gender-based violence, if you know someone who is experiencing violence, feel free to contact UNFPA country office in the country where you are. And UNFPA will be able to provide you with the latest up-to-date information on where you can find support, being from an NGO, being from the government, to really for you to have information about what are the services available in relation to gender-based violence.
Young people can teach old people. Men can teach women. Women can teach men. People in other areas of the gender spectrum have so much to teach us because they have such courage and they have such a unique perspective. But we've got to try and come off our high horse and go, what have you got for me? What have you got for me if I'm really listening? Very interesting.